billing fraud and ambulance services. An ambulance driver gets a ticket. Dallas community paramedic house calls. And we'll chat with our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center with her update on the detergent pod poisoning problems some children are having in communities around ours. If that's what you're looking for, guess what? You found it right here on this week's episode of the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the MediCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this week's episode. There's a great show coming up for you this week. We've got a lot of good news items for EMTs and paramedics out there, some interesting things we'll be taking a look at, including a look at what some Dallas EMS providers are doing to prevent hospital readmissions and cut back on some of their frequent flyer transports. Then, after the news items, we'll be bringing you another segment with Lisa Booz, a pharmacist and poison center expert we check in with, who regularly joins us with her Tox Tidbit segments. This time around, Lisa revisits her previous report on detergent pod poisoning she did last year at about this time. She has some updated research to share and more information on patient outcomes from these poisonings, and you'll definitely want to check that out later on in the episode. Before we get to all that, though, I do want you to make sure that you are checking out the additional links and additional information available for you over at the MedicCast blog. You'll find that over at MedicCast.com/blog. You'll find a show notes link at the top of the page. Just click that link and it'll take you right to the most recent episode. You can also scroll down there and find previous episodes if you're looking for something in particular. There's a search box on the right, so you can check for a certain keyword if you're looking for something we covered in the past. There's lots of different ways to utilize the site, but visit us over at the MedicCast blog. Take some time. Make sure you follow up on the information you get on the show, and make sure you understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. And when in doubt, always follow your own protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me, I hope you'll do so. You can email me here directly to podmedic@mac.com. Shoot me an email with your comments, your questions on the shows. Maybe send me suggestions and interview ideas you might have for future episodes. Either way, I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, and I'll get back to you as well, so keep those emails coming. Also, if you're an iPhone or an Android or a Windows Phone or a Windows 8 user, make sure you've got the brand new free MedicCast app. It's been out for a couple of months now. It's available in your device's store. Just search for MedicCast EMS app. And if you already have it, take a moment and go back and leave a comment and rate the app. It's really important that you do that. It shows you're an active supporter of the MedicCast community, and it lets somebody else looking at the app know what to expect from it and encourage them to download it. That's enough contact information. I'll go ahead and get into this week's news, but I do want you to remember to support our sponsors and make sure you let them know you heard about them here on the MedicCast. Tell them thanks for supporting the show. Starting off the EMS news items this week, we'll take a look at national attention given to ambulance services around the country who do routine interfacility and hospital and house transports. Medicare and Medicaid and other government insurance entities are looking long and hard at unnecessary ambulance transports for patients who are otherwise ambulatory. Now, I looked at a group in the past here on the show of Texas ambulance companies that were getting some of the scrutiny and investigative attention to their billing practices for what are essentially non-emergency transports to things like dialysis offices and doctor's appointments. Now in the news, an Orange County, California ambulance company is showing up as paying a $3 million settlement after they were investigated for improper billing practices, according to federal regulators. Now, their settlement admits no wrongdoing, and I'm not saying that they did anything wrong. Don't want to get sued here, but Basically, it seems to have revolved around allegedly transporting patients who weren't confined to bed and taking them to appointments and billing federal insurance programs for the service. Now, I want to caution EMS providers in these situations that while employers can be under corporate protection and pay just a fine and get out from under these allegations, sometimes the employees who are responsible for falsifying the records or the patient documentation, you may not get off so easily. I know of many situations on the hospital side of things where hospitals paid fines for improper billing, but the nurses who were pressured to alter patients' records to allow for higher billing codes were charged with fraud and lost their licenses. So I want to warn you to be very careful if your employer approaches you and asks you to do something that doesn't seem correct, or perhaps document a certain way for certain patients in order to get paid by insurance. It's one thing to thoroughly document so that insurance is going to pay for transport. You know, I understand that. That's the way to do it. But it's another to fudge a report because your employer says so. You might end up being in charge with insurance fraud while they skate off with a penalty because of their corporate status. So I want you to beware. Another cautionary tale this week for EMS providers is an EMS news story about an ambulance involved in a motor vehicle accident. The driver of that ambulance received a ticket for running a red light, even though they were running with lights and sirens. The ambulance struck a pickup truck that was crossing the intersection with the green light and caused that truck to overturn and caused injuries. Now, people, we need to stop running our units into other vehicles, okay? I know that seems simple, but we need to understand and approach all intersections with due regard to traffic laws. That means we stop at stop signs and stoplights and make sure the intersection is clear of all traffic and that everything's stopped before we keep going and proceed through. Pass other vehicles only when it's safe to do so, and protect yourself, your partner, and your patient when on transports. The more I see articles like this one, the more I think we need to take the lights off the units entirely. They don't significantly improve transport time. Most of the time, we use them simply because we can. Now, when you look at the aftermath of this accident and others like it, you begin to see the cost to the system. In this situation, two additional ambulances were needed. They had to go in and take the patient from the original ambulance to the hospital, as well as patients from the scene of the accident to the hospital. Add this to system costs where we have a unit that's no longer available for other calls and another ambulance that's put out of service because of the damage to it, and you begin to see how the cascade of events can cause huge system problems and costs. This is almost certainly going to incur a lawsuit as well for damages against the EMS driver and the EMS service involved. That's going to increase insurance costs for the company, and don't be surprised if the driver's insurance cost goes up. It's too much. Take some time, people. Slow down, proceed with caution. Your job is to get the patient to the hospital alive. Nothing in that statement says get him to the hospital fast. A minute or two, one way or the other, is not likely to matter, and the life you save may be your own. Finally, in the news this week, I take a look at how the concept of community paramedics is spreading to different places around the country. There's a great article this week in the Dallas Morning News blog about a small group of Dallas fire rescue paramedics. They will begin paying non-emergency visits to recently discharged patients to make sure they're squared away and recovering successfully at home after a hospital stay. These house calls are also going to include the 250 or so frequent flyers the system sees each year. And this is defined as patients who used EMS services 12 or more times in the previous year. The program is part of a partnership with local hospitals, and it's going to refer patients to the paramedics for follow-up, and they're going to work out some sort of reimbursement system with the fire rescue service for the attention they're paying to the hospital's patients. Now, as we know, patients who are readmitted within 30 days of discharge for certain illnesses incur penalties to the hospitals involved. Preventing these readmissions could save these hospitals millions of dollars. Of course, it'll also hopefully cut back on the ever-increasing number of ambulance calls that systems are taking and putting additional taxing on the EMS resources. Makes it hard for us to be available for real emergencies. The concept of community paramedic or mobile healthcare is one that I believe will change things to the point that EMS as we know it will no longer exist. Instead, we'll respond to patients without big expensive ambulances, perhaps in a simple sedan. See what the patient needs first. We may treat them on the scene. We might refer them to other services or to a doctor's appointment. We may even decide they can be transported to the hospital, but we can do it in the seat of the paramedic's sedan. Finally, if they actually require it, we can send for an ambulance and one will be sent out to pick them up and take them to the ER. But no longer will we automatically transport just because we're supposed to. We'll have the choice to provide appropriate care for the patients and get them the actual services they need and not just an ER. Are you looking at something like this in your area or at least considering it? I'd love to hear what you're doing and how you're doing it. So reach out to me here by email. Send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. Let me know what's going on in your neck of the woods. I look forward to hearing from you about your community paramedicine projects. We are joined again this week by pharmacist Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center with another of her tox tidbits on overdose and poisoning calls we might see when responding. Last year, Lisa Booz visited with us with a look at detergent pods and the increased number of poisonings reported involving them. She returns this week with an update on the subject with some additional research to back up the problem and point to possible treatments and outcomes for the patients we encounter with this issue. Now remember, as always, you should follow your protocols and rules regarding how you deal with and access and take orders from poison control. So make sure you understand your protocols and how you're supposed to take medical direction. But in any case, here's that segment with Lisa Booz on detergent pod poisonings. It's time for another Tox Tidbit segment with our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. Hi Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jamie. It's a pleasure to be back.
So what do we have this week?
Well, what I'd like to talk about is actually I would like to revisit a topic that we talked about several months ago, and that's the laundry detergent pods that are out. You might have heard that there was a recent news report of a 7-month-old who died after ingesting a laundry detergent pod. Now, we're still waiting on confirmation of the cause of death. It's pending as of September 1st, but the news report serves to remind us of the toxicity of these products, and this is something that really was quite unexpected to us. So the laundry detergent pods or packets, they're single dose. You basically just throw them in the washer. There's no measuring or pouring. And so they're marketed as a convenience product. And you know, nowadays we're all about convenience and saving time and resources. The packets contain very highly concentrated laundry detergent, usually in a clear membrane. And when you throw them into water, the membrane dissolves very quickly and releases the detergent. The packets were first marketed in Europe more than 10 years ago, and they were first seen on store shelves in the United States in around 2010 or so. They soon became very popular, and by 2012, there were multiple brands that you could find on store shelves here in the United States. So some of the common brands are Tide Pods, Arm & Hammer, Power Packs, All Mighty Packs, Ajax Toss-Ins, Purex Ultra Packs, and there are a lot of other brands now also. Why are kids eating these? Well, we think that the small size of the packets or the pods, the brightly colored liquid that's inside of them, and the squishy texture of the pods are attracting toddlers to them. And then the toddlers are doing just what they always do. They put them in their mouths and they bite down on them. The contents are under some pressure, so when they bite down on them, the liquid actually shoots back into the mouth and the throat. Now, children have been ingesting laundry detergents and other forms for decades, and poison centers hear about thousands of cases each year. Ingestions of those liquids and powders typically only result in mild GI upset, if anything at all. So when we get calls at poison centers, the kids might have some nausea, a little bit of abdominal pain, vomiting, and maybe some mouth irritation, and that's it. And the vast majority of the cases are treated at home, and they don't require any medical care. So we were really surprised when we started hearing about children developing really serious symptoms like respiratory depression, metabolic acidosis, and lethargy that progressed to unresponsiveness when the pods were being adjusted. And also with ocular exposures, we heard of some cases of corneal inflammation. Now, because these came out in Europe first, we can go back and we can look at their data to see that there were problems then as well. And there was a study done during 2010 to 2011 or so by a poison control center in Italy. And that poison center found that 76% of children exposed to the laundry detergent pods developed symptoms compared to only 27% of those that ingested other forms of laundry detergent. And around the same time, we started hearing about numerous case reports of serious symptoms with those pods in Europe. Now, we really couldn't predict or compare the experience in Europe with that in the United States because there could be differences in the pods. The membranes might be different, the detergents might be different, even with the same manufacturers. So we really didn't, or manufacturers here didn't really look at what was occurring in Europe to predict what was going to occur here. But soon after they started appearing on store shelves, poison centers here in the United States started receiving calls also. Most of these calls involved small children who had developed similar symptoms. In 2012, poison centers were called in the United States about more than 6,200 cases of laundry detergent pod exposures. And these were in children 5 years old and younger. And from January 1st to July 31st of 2013, there were more than 5,700 calls about small children ingesting or being exposed to these laundry detergent pods. Now, there was an article published in 2012 by the poison centers in Philadelphia and North Carolina, and these were the first reports of serious toxicity in the United States. And I'll describe them briefly because it will give you an idea of what we're seeing in these cases. The first case was a 20-month-old, and this child ingested the contents of a laundry detergent pod and developed profuse vomiting, gasping, wheezing, became unresponsive. When EMS arrived, they witnessed what they described as whole body jerking that lasted several minutes, and the child required intubation for airway protection. There were chest x-ray findings when chest x-ray was done in the emergency department that indicated aspiration. The second case was a 17-month-old who presented to the emergency department 30 minutes after partially ingesting a laundry detergent pod. He vomited, and then he soon became very drowsy. He was in moderate respiratory distress. He had coarse breath sounds bilaterally, and prior to intubation, he became fully unresponsive. The third case was a 10-month-old girl. She was brought to the emergency department immediately after ingesting a laundry detergent pod, and she was in moderate respiratory distress with gurgling respiration. She had stridor, tachycardia. She vomited several times, and her mental status was sort of waxing and waning, and x-rays showed that she had edema of her epiglottis. And then the fourth case in that series of cases that was first reported was a 15-month-old that bit into a laundry detergent pod and it exploded in her mouth. She vomited several times. 911 was called, and when EMS arrived 15 minutes later, she was sleepy and she soon became progressively more lethargic. She was intubated and her chest x-ray was normal. So all of these kids exhibited very severe symptoms that we don't see with traditional laundry detergents. Some of the effects could be from aspiration, but at least one of these kids didn't have any evidence of aspiration. Fortunately, all of these four children did fine, and all were discharged home several days after admission. Our poison center here in Maryland has been consulted on a number of children with similar toxic effects, and I know that other poison centers have as well. So what do we do for these kids? Well, treatment consists of supportive care and irrigation if the eyes and the skin are also involved. But be on the lookout for a very quick onset and deterioration in respirations and mental status. That you need to just be on top of things and be aware of that could occur really quickly. Intubation for airway protection might be required, and once they get to the hospital, we recommend chest x-rays to see if there's any evidence of aspiration or if the child has any respiratory distress, then that's an indication for a chest x-ray. Now, one question we really haven't been able to answer is why does this happen? Why are these pods causing serious symptoms? Well, it's really unclear, but there are some reasons that have been proposed. First, that maybe the ingredients differ from traditional forms of laundry detergents. Maybe there are pH differences, whether it's alkaline or acidic. Maybe there are higher concentrations in these pods of the detergent. Maybe that's what's causing it. Maybe the delivery of the contents under force when the child bites into the pod, maybe that's the problem. But we really don't know. And until more is known, we need to be real aggressive in educating the public about the hazards of these products and how important it is to keep them away from small children. Just a little background. One of the first TV ads for one of the brands actually showed a child, a small child, tossing the packet into the washing machine to show how easy they are to use. So it was a lot of people would think that it's okay for kids to handle and that they're really not toxic. Since then, the ads have been pulled, and also in some stores, they actually have put signs on the shelves with warnings, and some manufacturers have actually changed their packaging. For example, Procter & Gamble, the ones that make Tide Pods, they modified their packaging. The container was clear, so you could see the brightly colored pods inside, but now the container is no longer clear, and the lid is a little more difficult to open. But we know, like with other household cleaners and products, they need to be kept where the small hands can't get to them. That's the most important thing. And then lastly, we do recommend that you call the Poison Center to report these ingestions so that we can help you with recommendations for treatment. But also, we want to gather information on these cases so that we can learn more about the products. So call your Poison Center at the number is 800-222-1222.
And it's important to revisit that, you know, prevention really is the key with these types of detergents and household cleaners, that this is a preventable problem. If they're kept out of the reach of children, we can avoid this altogether.
That's absolutely true. And certainly that's been a problem with a lot of these cases, is that the products have been kept on top of the washer or the pods have been left out and very easy for kids to get into them. A lot of parents, when we get calls about children that have ingested these products, they seem very surprised that they could be that toxic. And to be honest, I've had a number of health professionals, physicians, nurses, EMS providers who have called about cases and they've been very surprised about how toxic these are. So I think it's not only education of the parents and the caregivers of small children, but we also need to educate the healthcare providers about how toxic these are so that they can be familiar with what to look for in these cases, but also so that they can help to reinforce to parents and their patients to keep these products away from kids.
Well, we'll make sure we get the word out, and that's one of the reasons we do these spots. So, Lisa, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jamie. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week and remind you to follow up on all of the information from this week's show. You'll find it over at mediccast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a link in the show notes for the top of the at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on the information and the links to news items and other things you'll find there each week. You can also sign up for the email newsletter. That's right there on the right-hand side of the page. Put in your name and email address, and it'll bring those links directly to your email inbox each week. So just fill that out and get that right to you and get the MedicCast weekly newsletter. I also welcome your comments and your suggestions by email directly, so shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com and send in your ideas for future episodes, like today's topic of traumatic asphyxiation. Send in your interview segments or whatever comments you have. I look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media sites or social media pages, well, you can find me most places under the handle PodMedic. So go ahead and catch me over on Twitter at twitter.com/PodMedic or over on Facebook, facebook.com/PodMedic. Make sure you friend or follow me over there so we can catch up online. And don't forget to check out the MedicCast Facebook page. We have almost 5,000 followers right now. So head over and check out the page over at facebook.com/MedicCast. Click the like button at the top of the page and join our community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with people you know, your colleagues, your students, if you're an EMS instructor, friends in the EMS world, and let them know about the show. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, interviews, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. So tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, most importantly, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.